Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Progressive News Network. This is Mickey Royce as our fearless leader is off in the wild, wild west visiting his grandkids. So it's just us chickens. Anyway, we've got fantastic, brilliant people on the show today, and we'll tell you about that in a second. But I wanted to give you a little bit of information, since we don't usually have time for that, that might be useful to you. Number one, if you want to know how your representative, either at federal or state level, has voted, you can go to a MegaVote, which is presented by C-SPAN, and that website URL is congress.org/Congress.org/MegaVote. And if you do that, you can fill in a little form. They'll send you an email, and they'll tell you periodically how your guy voted or your gal voted, and I find it very useful to kind of look at that and, you know, what's what. And you can also, there's links to email them directly. So it's kind of like one-stop shopping. And there is another site that you can get nonpartisan, unbiased information from about the whole country, and that's called Project Vote Smart. And it's the URL is votesmart.org, and it's really, really good. Oops, I look like I'm getting it. One more thing, FloridaRedistricting.org is where you can get information about the redistricting effort that's going on in Florida. And that is, I have a list of the, if there's time, I'll read you the list, but I think we have, is that you, Keith?
This is Keith McHenry with Food Not Bombs, yes.
Hello, Keith McHenry with Food Not Bombs. How are you?
Great. I just rode a bike over to a Food Not Bombs meeting, and that was a lot of fun.
Oh, cool. Well, now, you know, I did a little research while I was waiting here to do this, and you have 400 chapters around the world?
It's about 1,000 chapters around the world.
Old information.
At a minimum, there's like 400, and there's us. I guess it's 485 that we have listed on the website. But we know that, for instance, in Russia, there's in the area of about 60 cities, and we only have 17 listed. And this is very common where, you know, I know there are a lot of groups in Brazil, and I have none of them listed. So so it's very huge. And, we estimate it's around 10,000 people that are doing Food Not Bombs.
That's a lot of people. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so, all right, so we know that you have this peace organization that advocates feeding the hungry and not blowing people up. That's the peasant definition, I know, I understand. So what are the recent developments? I understand you were arrested. We heard you tell us about that in Orlando. What happened? What's the latest?
Well, okay, well, I was arrested on June 22nd and held 17 days. And during that time, we had a protest scheduled for City Hall where we're going to share food on July 1st. And the mayor, actually, early on, after the first several arrests, Mayor Buddy Dyer, had told the media that, you know, they shouldn't do it in our crown jewel park, Lake Eola Park, but they could do it in front of City Hall. Well, actually, City Hall turned out to be one of the parks that's illegal to share food in more than twice in 1 year if you're going to share food to more than 24 people. So he actually hasn't arrested us since we started sharing there, even though technically it's illegal. And so now we're working to see if we can make that, change the ordinance so that we don't have to be risking arrest sharing food at City Hall. And we're also trying to change the build political pressure so that we could actually share in the parks freely as we have for years in Orlando and for 30 years across the world. And then, we just got news this weekend that a church group was just told that you were not allowed to share food on public land in Tampa. And this is a new development. And we know that there's also a discussion in Sarasota, Florida. They were going to pass a law, but it was limited to you couldn't share more than 12 meals in their city parks. But then what ended up happening is because of the arrests in Orlando, they've kind of backed off, and the number of cities, including Fort Lauderdale and so on, have stopped pursuing their ordinances, at least overtly. And we think that the action of risking arrest and getting arrested in Orlando has had a positive effect, and it stopped a lot of cities from enacting limitations to the sharing of free food with the hungry.
Wow, hang on just a second. I'm getting these calls. We're going to have like more than one person on the line at the same time, but I just see that we now have, is this Luis on the other line?
Yes, Mickey, this is Luis. How are you?
Hi, Professor Cuevas. How are you? We were just talking to Keith McHenry, and he is filling us in on what's happened since he was arrested and all the domino effect that's going on, and it's kind of interesting. So go on, Keith. Go ahead.
Yeah, so basically, you know, now we're in a situation where we're trying to take one park back at a time in Orlando, but as I say, we've had some pretty good success. So we had to, you know, we had a meeting yesterday in Fort Myers to discuss what was happening statewide with Food Not Bombs and anti-sharing ordinances. And so, like I say, we've stopped a lot of these laws from being actually enforced or being formally introduced into the local town legislatures, with the exception of Tampa, which is this thing where actually we have an agreement with Tampa not to bother us, the city of Tampa, stemming from four arrests several years ago, but because of the Republican National Convention, they seem to have just started going around telling people that they can't share food. And also the Tampa Food Not Bombs just restarted after having not been involved, but, you know, active in that town for several years now. Although the St. Petersburg chapter has been very active at Mirror Park, and they proposed a law that was a total ban on outdoor food sharing in that city, and we've stopped that from being passed as well. Unfortunately, though, I am getting lots of calls from people living on the streets that are telling me that that they're being harassed and by the police. And I had several guys call me yesterday from Orlando saying that the police had driven everybody that looked homeless out of Lake Eola Park yesterday afternoon and told them that they weren't allowed to come back to the downtown area. And one man, John, is a vet, you know, and he was very upset that he risked his life for America, and now he's not allowed to be down by the public library in his hometown.
So now let me ask you a question, because I was thinking about this as I ran some errands this morning. It's like, who's behind this? What is the, I mean, is it the Chamber of Commerce? Is it the restaurants that don't giving away free food? I mean, what's really going on?
Well, in Orlando, according to our attorney, who has been active here he's been an attorney here for over 21 years, and he is really connected to the local, government here, and he's in the Democratic Party and so on. He thinks it's just a very small number of people, potentially just one or two condo owners, you know, maybe a handful of condominium owners, and a very small number of developers that are behind this, and that actually most people think that the ordinance is completely crazy. The crazy thing that happened in Orlando is that we had been sharing on one side of Lake Eola Park, not really realizing there was actually a picnic area with tables and stuff on the other side of the park. And a ranger came to us in 2006 and said, you know, you could serve on the other side. We actually built something for people like you guys to share food. So we moved over there, and we've been there ever since. It is a wonderful place to be sharing food. We share twice a week, breakfast on Mondays and dinners on Wednesdays. And it was 6 months after we moved to this location that we find out by accident that there's going to be an ordinance limiting our meals introduced before city council. So they never came to us and never talked to us. There was never any formal debate. And this small handful of people in the real estate community came out and spoke in favor of the ordinance. One or two residents came out to speak in support of the ordinance. Other residents came and said they thought it was crazy. And we've actually had a lot of the local business people and condominium owners come and sign our petitions and come out and hold signs with us, and they're outraged. So it's not like the the people of Orlando are upset that there's people eating at Lake Eola Park. It's a very small number of people. Now, in other cities, in San Francisco, for instance, we discovered that it was actually Bechtel, Chevron, Bank of America, and some other military contractors that were concerned that the public, and it's a much different thing in San Francisco in some ways. We were sharing a Golden Gate Park. This was 1988.
Okay, this is a while ago.
And we had hundreds of people eating with us, you know, so it was a huge scene. A lot of tourists hung out with us because of where it was at Golden Gate Park, and we actually asked for a permit and wrote letters, went to the Parks Department to see if we could get the permit that a local individual suggested that we'd be able to get. And we never got any answer until August 15th of 1988 when 45 riot police emerged from Golden Gate Park and arrested 9 of us and charged us for sharing food without a permit. But then when we investigated further, by the time there was 94 arrests, we came to understand that there was actually not such a process and there were no such permits. So the mayor actually created a permit to give to us so he could stop the arrests. And that's how those arrests stopped at Golden Gate Park in 88.
So Luis, do you have any knowledge of anything in Florida that has happened recently in addition to Orlando?
Well, yes, it's happening throughout the state, state of Florida. And what you find is that it varies in degree. In terms of whom they're targeting and where they're targeting. In terms of the homeless population, usual is something about panhandling, and they have rules and regulations about that. They've been enacting laws to forbid anybody from panhandling and or giving to somebody else. There have been laws enacted in Gainesville, Florida, for example, where it is illegal to actually give food to another person within the city of Gainesville, city hall. And so you find this, which is coming up to targeting specific groups of people at specific times. There's not only that, there have been also rules and regulations enacted for the homes. As in Gainesville, there is a St. Francis home, which not only feeds but also offers a temporary housing, 32 beds for homeless, and they're not to exceed certain numbers. Once they do, they begin to get in trouble, and then one of the things that local governments do is to go after zoning laws. That means that this whole thing varies per community. Essentially, how affluent the community might be, and then determining on whether you have a influx of tourists through that area. There are counties which actually require a license for somebody to do any panhandling, basically begging. Which is absurd, but those are the extremes that we are seeing. That happens in Marion County, Florida, city of Ocala. There is also the process of deputy sheriffs actually picking up a homeless person and taking them out to the county line and saying, "You go that way."
That happens. A tragedy. If this happened, you know, in 1980. In 1987 and 86, I was a merchant, a businessman in Boston, and I was approached to take a photograph of a homeless man and said wanted and make a sign that said wanted out of Kenmore Square, which is where my office was, And we were approached by the city police department, who came and gave us a lecture about how the Justice Department had done several studies and had shown that the reason we weren't having enough business in our neighborhood, enough retail business, was because of the presence of homeless people, hippies, bums, and others. They had a whole list of people, punks. The punk rock was, you know, starting to make its face big in the area. And it's a strange thing because it's a student area near a bunch of colleges, and there was a lot of nightclubs, and that's where the Red Sox were playing at Fenway Park. Mm-hmm. So it's very, you know, lots of people wandering through this neighborhood. And it turned out that there was a national program called the Community Oriented Policing Services, and they were going from city to city when local authorities would see that there were too many homeless people, things like that, then they would bring in this national program. And I travel a lot across America speaking at colleges, and I've noticed the same signs. There's a campaign called Give a Hand Up, Not a Hand Out, and you can download that off the Justice Department website. And they provide you with a whole series of potential laws that you can create, the anti-panhandling law, permit process, no sit, no lie laws, which are very common now. Like in Orlando, mm-hmm. you can't lay down horizontally in the day, and you can't be in the parks after dark, you know, so that it makes it very hard to be a low-income person living outside in these areas. And they also have a catalog that the Justice Department provides that has anti-homeless architecture catalog. And so you might have noticed about the early 80s that all the park benches started having little loops through the middle of the mm-hmm. of them, so you couldn't lay down, and there became little spikes that they could put on along walls so no one could sit on them. And there's a whole campaign. It's called Quality of Life Enforcement and Quality of Life Crimes, and the most famous study that was been used to advocate this nationwide policy, it was called the Broken Window Study, and a lesser well-known study was called The Homeless Are Not People Like You and I. And these were justified to create this matrix of laws that have been used against homeless people all over the United States.
It's amazing.
So I have a question before I forget. Yeah. What if you said it was a company picnic?
Well, you can say all kinds of things. We've done company picnics and were arrested. We did.
Oh, really? We
divided. The biggest issue is the fact that our literature and our sign and our banners. And the biggest problem is that we're saying that resources should be redirected from the military towards human needs. And that is the real issue. So one of the campaigns that's happened in the United States, when they made over 1,000 arrests in San Francisco, they beat us viciously on the streets while sharing food. We have a video called Phenol Bomb's Greatest Hits. I faced 25 to life in prison in California for this. Eventually they realized that all this money and resources wasn't working. So what they ended up doing is I worked for the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, a Native American political prisoner, in 1997, and I was on probation for all this police violence that occurred to me in San Francisco, so I needed a break. And I moved out of town, and a new volunteered to bring the banner and the literature, which he accidentally lost in a dumpster on the way to the meal. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be the most effective strategy, is to throw the banner and the literature away. And so people just think it's a church group handing out some free food, and our chapter was never bothered again. Correct. It's the message that's the problem. They don't care if we're sharing free food. It's that it's okay that people think homeless people are somehow failures, drug addicts, they didn't pray enough, or whatever their problem was that supposedly caused them to be homeless. But it's not a problem with society. It's like the money is being spent correctly in the military, 50 cents of every federal tax dollar. It's okay that we have these wars. That's not a problem. That we bail out the bankers, that's not a problem. The problem is that these people just won't go get a job when the unemployment rate is so super high, and they won't go get a college degree when you can't possibly afford it. and they won't go rent an apartment when there's no possible way that working three jobs just gives you enough money to give you a deposit and pay for a monthly rent. So this is what the problem is. The problem is that we're saying we can make sure no one has to stand in a soup line to get food if we just changed our political priorities and started funding things like universal health care and education. And if you go to a country with universal health care and financed education, you don't see hundreds and thousands of homeless people wandering the streets. You know, you mm-hmm. just doesn't
yeah,
but happen.
They didn't have Ronald Reagan either.
Correct. In fact, the only European country where you start seeing lots and lots of homeless people was in England with Margaret Thatcher. So the two countries that were most devastated directly from Reaganomics in the Chicago School of Economic Theories and the shock doctrine, as Naomi Klein talks about, were really the most hardest hit originally were the United States and England across the, across the channel. You know, there weren't masses of homeless people wandering Germany and France and Belgium and even in Italy or Spain. You know, this is that the actual homeless problem in those countries is relatively recent, and that's because they started to adopt the trickle down economic theories
nice.
Of Ronald Reagan.
Isn't that special?
Yeah, Keith, may I ask a question of you?
Yes.
Because I was thinking our listeners would like to know, as many of them, particularly activists, have an idea, but many people don't understand who we're talking about when we mention a homeless person. Whom are we really talking about? And the fact that, just to make a point here, is that a huge percentage now, a growing percentage, is made up of families, and that's about 240,000 people who are in families, and hundreds of thousands of children who are homeless. So, people have a perception or an idea of who might be a homeless, but they don't understand the complexity of this.
Yeah, in fact, many people that you might be at work with, standing right next to you, like in a retail store or at a factory or warehouse on a construction site, may in fact be homeless. You know, in fact, I myself am personally homeless and have been homeless for a number of years. So I know, like, some statistics. For instance, Santa Fe, New Mexico, is a very fancy, upscale community,
mm-hmm.
The capital of New Mexico. And the city school board, or the public schools, has at least, they say that at least 700 of the children going to school in Santa Fe public schools are homeless children. And that's not a very big town. That's a town roughly the size of Orlando. And to have that many children that live on the streets going to public schools is outrageous. And you also, many people are... You know, they try to survive in different ways, and it's a degree towards homelessness. You might initially stay with your mom and dad or with your children because it might be no fault of your own, for instance, that your landlord actually couldn't meet their payments, and they foreclosed, and you were forced out onto the streets. Or, you might not even be homeless. This is another crazy story I just recently heard when I was in Michigan. These people were working in the auto industry. They knew they were not going to be, they were being laid off. They knew they weren't going to be able to make their house payments. So there were seven families living on the lake in this one little road. They all met with one another. They decided, let's give up six of the houses. We'll only pay the mortgage on one. And all the families moved into that one house. So there is another woman I spoke at a conference with in California. They had bought a house near her ailing mother. Her husband was an engineer. He started to, they announced they were going to lay him off. They tried to make arrangements that they thought were lawful and legal to change their payment structure on their mortgage. And it turned out on behind their backs, Bank of America ended up getting their mortgage and evicted them and refused to honor the agreements that they had signed, and they brought the paperwork to show the bank, saying, "Look, we signed all this, all these agreements, and why aren't you honoring it?" And they said, "Because we don't have those documents in our files; those are in your files. That's you paid the notary to notarize those contracts, but since we can't find them in the Bank of America files, we're foreclosing on you." And sure enough, a couple of days later, they came back, and there was an auction of their house. And this is family after family. I could tell personal stories of people I know that have gone through similar things over and over and over again. So it's middle America that is becoming homeless. And it's, I have a close family of Mary, who I write about in my new book. She comes to Food Not Bombs in Taos, New Mexico. We're a small town. And her children are with her, and she's come up before, but she was crying, and I didn't know why she was so upset. Well, the same thing happened to her, where her family were builders in our town, built eco-friendly solar houses. They couldn't make their mortgage. They were losing their life's dream, and they were eating at Food Not Bombs because they needed the food. And these were some of the most well-respected, community members that people thought of as being, well-off and a stable family. And she was worried about losing her relationship with her husband, and she was a nervous wreck. And her poor children were a nervous wreck, having huge emotional problems from this. And so this is the story of America. This is like literally, I think it's roughly 2 million people are estimated to be homeless in America. And many of the people that are single and homeless are single because of the fact of being homeless. People that are coping with alcohol and drug problems, in my experience, I've been feeding people for 31 years on the streets. Many of them had no substance abuse problems before they got on the streets, and the anxiety and pain and suffering meant that it was the cheapest way to cope was to buy, 40 ounces.
With all the pain.
So this is, it's not like they were alcoholics and drunks and then became homeless. It's the other way around. And that doesn't mean that all homeless people, many, many homeless people, I mean, the shocking number of people eating with Food Not Bombs are not even homeless. We have people from Lake Eola Park that were eating with us that actually own condos right there. But they were eating with us because that meant that they didn't have to pay for another meal. And that meant that maybe they could save their condominium, and they were eating there to save money. And, we have many women and children and families eating with Food Not Bombs, many of them not homeless, but many that just don't have enough money to make all their other bills, and they have to make a choice. And since the thing that's possible is a free meal, that's why they eat with us.
So let me do a question. First of all, I have somebody on hold. My third guest is Joe Pishkar, and he is the president of the the Space Coast Progressive Alliance. Are you there?
Yes.
Cool.
Hi.
Yeah,
just
I'm here.
I want to make sure. I didn't forget you. It's just I needed to wait. So, because we're going to go to a different topic at the very bottom of the hour, because that's kind of like I sort of kind of divided it in my head anyway. but, Keith, what is the name of your new book, and where can people buy it?
Okay, my new book is called Hungry for Peace, and it's how to end war and poverty with Food Not Bombs. And the best thing to do is to go to foodnotbombs.net, and you can follow the links for the book. It's labeled on the front of the index page, foodnotbombs.net. And I have like a PDF of the book. It's actually going to the publisher tomorrow, and it should be a hard copy of that book coming out in the next sometime in October.
Okay. All right. So this is an advance.
Yeah, it's the first time I've told anybody about this, other than the people working on it with me. Yeah, and it's 128 pages. It's an 8.5 by 11 format, paperback. C Sharp Press, who published my last book, is publishing this book there in Tucson, Arizona. So it will be listed on Amazon. Amazon and so on as well.
Oh, good. It'll be on Amazon. Well, and the other thing is when people go to the website of Food Not Bombs, if you poke around a little bit, you can actually look up Keith's name. I did a Google. Keith is also a graphic artist. He's got all kinds of artwork that he has done over the years. And some, I like some, it's really some very, very nice things there. So he's a lot, I mean, all men that we have on the line tonight are very accomplished, and we could easily spend hours talking to each one of them alone, but we're not going to do that. So I want to play a 3-minute and 43-second clip, okay, of an address that was done by Joe Pishkar at a recent redistricting hearing, because redistricting is a very, very important subject, certainly for the state of Florida, since it was voted in by the voters. It's being, you know, stalled and all kinds of stuff. So I want to hear, I understand that this is really, so in, by way of introduction, I'm going to push this button, and hopefully we will be able to all listen to it together, okay?
Great.
Thank you. My name is Joe Pishkar, and I live in West Melbourne. I'm represented by State Representative John Tobias and State Senator Mike Cardopoulos. On behalf of the citizens of Brevard County and the State Coast Progressive Alliance, I'd like to nominate the Florida State Legislature for a Tony Award in the category of political theater. In the past few weeks, you've provided considerable value and entertainment by hosting a series of sham meetings to request feedback on a process that has not yet begun. While states as contentious as California and as bureaucratic as Massachusetts have somehow managed to generate first and second drafts already of their redistricting maps, you languished and agonized over how transparent you are by providing the public with a piece of software that even hardcore geeks and nerds find daunting, clumsy, and altogether pointless. These proceedings are a farce, part of a blatant delay that many consider the incumbent protection program. Many other states have already completed their redistricting: South Carolina, Michigan, Iowa, Missouri, Indiana, and Texas. Minnesota is nearly done. Oklahoma has been done for some time now. Can you honestly expect us to believe that our redistricting should naturally proceed at a slower pace than Oklahoma's? If the state where humans have been blasted into orbit for the past half a century somehow technologically inferior to Oklahoma, is there a special redistricting bottle that we can borrow on loan from Oklahoma at some point to help speed things along? What precisely are these hearings for? I mean, apart from the massive waste of taxpayer dollars that each of you chalk up expenses attending these to your office accounts, you want our feedback. What exactly? Third district passed with 63% of the vote. You've given us nothing to provide feedback on. Yes, on the surface, the thing is transparent, but there's no substance behind the glass to speak of. You've had census data for months now. Is there no one in Tallahassee with Google Maps, Microsoft Office, and a wide format printer? And asking us to draw the maps for you is even further a stretch, a contemptible attempt to crowdsource blame for the incumbent favoring maps you'll end up producing on your incumbent favoring timeline. You'll pick the map that best suits the preservation of incumbents and point to the adorable little Aunt Betty sitting on her front porch with a glass of lemonade and a MacBook, and my district builder loaded up.
I just want to hear more about Aunt Betty. Just because we have it now about 10 more people who want to speak, in deference to them, if you can.
Sorry, that might occupy my 3 minutes. Or
you just have a little bit of time, so if you can
short out. You'll point to Aunt Betty, and you'll say it wasn't us, it was Aunt Betty. But by that point in time, candidates qualifying will be upon us. Candidates who do not have the incumbents in tight track on districts will not even know what their districts look like. How long will candidates have to wait until they know what their districts look like? How long? Nothing of the advocates is going to read now.
I'm going to ask you to summarize, please, and just take about 10 seconds.
We demand the expeditious drawing of fair, nonpartisan election districts. We demand that you put a stop to these fake hearings, these pointless, futile practices of navel gazing that you seem fit to extend our tax dollars on and focus maybe, I don't know, on something more important like jobs.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Wow. So, Joe, how was the farce?
That was
That was quite a farce that they put on there. And they're doing this all over the state. They're expending taxpayer money in putting on this little show of transparency. And as I mentioned in the speech, they're attempting to be transparent about something, but there's nothing behind the transparency. There's no substance at all. There's nothing going on. There's nothing for us to provide input on. Usually when redistricting hearings happen, as they have in the past, the legislators will draw the maps, or a third party will draw the maps, and then they'll put them forward for input, for community input, for voter input and feedback. In this case, they're sort of putting the cart before the horse in this little dog and pony show, to run the rest of the analogy there, and they're basically obfuscating what's going on. They're pushing back as far as they can into 2012 to make absolutely certain that no one running for office right now on the state level as a state legislator, either Senate or House of Representatives, has any clue whether or not they're going to live in the district that they may live in right now or that they may end up in. And this is something that's causing some issues here locally. Already we have in Brevard County, we have something like three different candidates who have all announced for the same House District 30, on the Democratic side. They have no idea if they're going to be ending up against Representative Rich Workman. They don't know if they're going to end up in the same district together. They may be two or three districts apart. It's really quite absurd what they're doing right now. They're spending a ton of taxpayer money, not only to oppose Amendments 5 and 6, which the voters voted for by 63%, but they're also, which incidentally, that money being expended is going straight to Dean Cannon's law firm. Not only are they spending money opposing it, but they're spending money flying and moving all of these state legislators around the state. At least there were at least, I'd say, 12, probably more than that, legislators who were there, along with their legislative aides, along with their support people, who were present at this sham meeting. And it costs money to move those people around. They're not taking a red eye. They're not coming down from Tallahassee and going back up the following day. They're staying nights in a hotel. You know, they're charging the mileage for their cars. This is all being billed to their office account. So, you know, we're not only spending money to oppose 5 and 6, but we're also spending money on this political theater, these theatrics that are being put forward by our state senators and our state representatives in a pretend open hearing to get feedback on something that doesn't quite exist yet. What exactly are they anticipating we're going to show up and say, other than show us the maps? No maps have been created yet, and they want feedback on what? I guess the Fair Districts, the My District Builder software. I tried to use this piece of software, and it's cumbersome and it's difficult. And I'm a tech guy. You know, I grew up with Super Mario and Civilization and you name it, Warcraft. I grew up playing all these games, and I even built some of them. I can't figure out how to use this program. It's not intuitive. It's very difficult. But also, like I said in the speech, what they intend to do, and it became clear over a period of time as they started to tout this transparent effort, because call me cynical, but whenever these guys, this group of good old boys, get together and start preaching and banging their chests about how transparent they're about to be, I always look at it with a very cynical eye, and it kind of dawned on the Space Coast Progressive Alliance why they were doing this. They're crowdsourcing the blame. They want to eventually be able to point to a map that's been created by a citizen that benefits them as much as possible, that yields to the incumbent as much as possible, and then say, we didn't do that, they did this. This is what they put forward. So we're blameless in this,
Is there, I don't know, I'm forgive my ignorance, is there anything anybody can do about this dog and pony show? I mean, can it be challenged in court or anything like that, that this is a waste of taxpayer dollars and it's defeating the purpose or anything like that?
Not really. I mean, they're allowed to chalk up certain expenses to their office accounts if approved by the Speaker and by the Senate President and by their own parties. The theatrics themselves are not in any way illegal. They're just very obviously for show because there's nothing to show.
Going to this meeting without a map is kind of like, I don't know, coming to text without a pen.
They're not prepared, but they're doing this as a way of delaying, as a way of saying we want to push back as much as we can, so that, or from what I understand now, the maps, the first iteration of the maps will be available sometime in March of 2012. Now that's not to say that the maps are going to be approved by then, but just to put that in perspective, we have candidates who are running right now, and if you're a serious candidate, you have to announce at least a year out in order to start raising the money that it takes to be considered viable and in order to raise your name ID. What they're doing with this is they're making it so that no one really knows where the heck they're going to be running. So you can't go to your constituents and say, I'm candidate X and I'm running for city A, B, and C as your state representative. You have to say, I'm not really sure where exactly. I mean, I'm in District 30 right now. I'm in District 31, but who knows what it's going to be. You might be able to vote for me. You might not be able to vote for me, but please, for the love of God, write me a check.
What do you recommend that voters go to these redistricting hearings?
I do. I recommend everybody who's out there goes to one of these things and sign up to speak. It's really fun, as you heard from the little clip. It's really fun to point out the fact that these are absolutely a sham farce hearings where there is absolutely zero substance. And ask them, where exactly are the maps? Where are the maps? Why aren't you showing us the maps? As I mentioned in my speech, even Oklahoma is done. Oklahoma. How can we be technologically inferior to Oklahoma and other states with more contentious redistricting processes, like California? As I mentioned, California is almost done with their redistricting. Almost, it's 2011 and they're already almost done.
What is it you just said? It's not the process. It's the legislatures that are.
It's the legislature, yeah, because they're dragging
their feet.
They're
a pain in the butt.
They know that right now in Florida,
there is a
majority.
Comes from the legislature. That's what I wanted to say.
It does.
If somebody wants to go to one of these redistricting meetings and speak, they have to make a reservation to RSVP first, right?
Yes, they do, and they can do that. They can do that online if they sign up through the My District Builder, the Redistricting Florida website.
FloridaRedistricting.org. FloridaRedistricting.org.
And it's worth noting, for anybody who attempts to speak, be very well aware there's one clear tactic that they're using. Senator Gates in particular has made effective use of this. In order to distract a person who is speaking against fair districts, in order to distract someone who's speaking out against the legislature dragging their feet, what they do is they wait for a certain moment, like maybe about a minute and a half into your speech, into what you're saying, and then they interrupt you. And he usually says, please be respectful of your friends and neighbors who are here who also want to give a chat. And try and draw it to a close. Whatever he can do to draw your attention, to distract you, to unsettle you, and to kind of shut you up. They do that constantly. He did it for almost every single person who spoke in favor of fair districts and who was critical about the legislature's efforts
in
opposing amendments.
What a nice guy.
It's an interesting tactic to just sort of interrupt a person during their limited 3-minute opportunity to speak, and to say, you know, just basically, hey, there are other people who want to speak. It sounds like he's being courteous. They're actually not being courteous. They just want to interrupt you. So if you do speak, make sure you front load it with, please don't interrupt me while I'm speaking. I'm aware of my time. I will use my time courteously with response to my neighbors. Now, where are the maps? then proceed
Good.
From there. These guys are skilled when it comes to using these types of tactics against the public.
No doubt they are. And so on that note, I want to segue to the other topic I wanted to discuss tonight. And Luis is the Professor Cuevas. Luis Cuevas is the National Director of Progressive Push, and they are an organization dedicated to electing, grooming, finding, and electing progressive candidates. So I wanted to kind of talk about that for a little bit, and I know, Joe, you told me you were grooming some yourself, so I figured, Luis, if you want to talk about what can we tell our listeners to, what do you want to tell them to do?
Well, essentially, one of the most important things people have to realize that all politics, as Tip O'Neill used to say, all politics is local. We begin at the local level. I know a lot of people are mesmerized by the whole thing of the political campaign at the national level, and it's particularly interesting with all the congressional candidates and all that. But when we come down to it, the real impact upon our lives is our local policy makers. The candidates that we have running for dog catcher, if there's such a position, the school board, city commissioner, county commissioner, the state representative, the district senate representatives, those are the extremely important positions because they do have a bearing upon everything that affects our lives. And we want to make absolutely sure that people understand that from the get-go, you need to find out if you're interested in politics, your background, does it fit what you want to do? I mean, you can't just wake up one morning and say, I'm going to run for Congress. You just don't do that because it's much more difficult than you think. And the same thing for City Hall. The situation is that you have to at least begin to plan 2-3 years ahead of time. And the next thing is you need to find out if your finances are okay with that. I see candidates that, you know, jump in the ring and they say, I'm running for this, but they don't have a job. And then they cannot campaign. And they cannot organize because they're troubled with their finances and everything else. That's not a serious way to do it. You really must plan ahead. You must be sure what the job is, what the job entails, what your capabilities are, if it's suited for you. And then one of the most important things is, can you have the support or your family and your friends? Can you really make it? Can you really go out there and get yourself 1,000 persons whom you know and you can ask for them, listen, or you can tell them, I am running for city commissioner and I need seed money for my campaign. Can you give me $25? For my campaign, just that, just $25. If you think of that, and you're talking about 1,000 persons, it takes, that's a test. You need to come up with a real, a serious campaign making. You just can't leave it for a last minute, like Joe said. I mean, it's 1 year from election time. A year and a half, you need to make absolutely sure that you have all the planning for that. You just can't jump into it, especially if it's a I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, I was just questioning if it's is like, do you on your website, does it you have like a checklist, a basic checklist that somebody could look at before they even go contact you or anything or anything
we're
like
really
that? Any
that,
kind of tool?
Yeah, unfortunately, we were hacked badly. We must be doing something good because we were blasted. We were blasted, and a number of things that we had on our site disappeared. So we are rebuilding very quickly. We should be done by the end of this week. But,
wow.
Yeah, but it's one of those amazing things. But yes, that's what we want to do. We want to give people the tools. Thinking over the whole process and then throwing, if they want to throw their hat in the ring, then do it the very positive way. You know, go ahead. There's many steps to take. And I'll tell you one thing. From the get-go, you need to, if you're going to run for office, you need to think in terms of there are three very, very important things. People, time, and money. And then you're always going to be running out. You can always replace people. You can always replace money. You can bring more, but then you run out of time. And, it hurts to have met so many good candidates whom we talked to, and we've been trying to get them to get things going. And they tell me, you know what, if I had one more month, and he said, you never have enough time. That's what you got to give yourself. Put it on your head. In fact, people, here's a tip that we had from our website before it flew off. Get yourself a countdown clock. And the countdown clock, starts with the beginning of early voting, at the very least. Vote by mail starts earlier. So to be safe, at least put it at that distance. When does early voting begin? Because that's when the votes start coming inside to the supervisor of election. So you need to count back and then plan your whole campaign in a calendar. And you have that countdown clock that is constantly ticking. It's on your desktop, your laptop. You open it, and it says you have so many days left to election day. You see? And that gives you a sense of urgency. If you've got to be ready for that. You've got to make sure that you go for that. You just can't leave it for the very last minute because you won't be able to make up for that time. And in terms of money, money is really important. But I tell you what can kill and make up for money is an army of volunteers. I've been struggling with candidates, and I keep telling them, listen, go out there, get more volunteers. And they just take their time and say, do it. Go get more volunteers. But I was a county commissioner. I can make a county. I can win the county. Is it not with 20 volunteers? That can't happen. You see, you just don't understand. That
by now, people should have observed what happened in Wisconsin. They won, not because those two seats because of volunteers, because they had feet on the ground, not because they had a lot of money.
Exactly. That's the key. You see, that somebody, the biggest, key to all this is Steve Forbes. Steve Forbes put in millions of dollars of his own pocket to run for president of the United States, and he had to pull out. Why? Because he did not have the thrust. He did not have the backing. He could not get the volunteers. He had to pay for people to stand on a street corner holding a sign for him, you see. So that happens.
Well, he must be a really warm individual. That's why.
Right. Well, actually, he is the vice chair of the national organization that backs the Tea Party. You see, most people don't. It's not just Dick Armey; it's Steve Forbes.
I can actually comment
all of that is behind that. Yes.
I can actually comment a little towards the candidate aspect. One of the most important things that we've found locally, and you know, from candidate to candidate, because there's stuff that candidates share that is kind of they're kind of hard-learned lessons. One of the things is how much value you can get out of the DFA training, the Democracy for America training.
Right.
I think that's tremendous stuff. And one of the things that I've tried to talk into the candidates here is definitely that sense of urgency, because there has to be near the end of the election cycle, those couple of weeks running up, there begins to develop a sense of almost desperate urgency, like a desperation to ensure that you're winning. And the smart candidate, the smartest candidate, develops that a year ahead of time.
Yes.
Because they know that, and I know this because I ran back in 2010 against Representative John Tobia locally for District 31. I know that because I lost and because he won, there are actual consequences. There's stuff that happened because he is now the state legislator for our area. He put forward bills that passed. He co-sponsored bills that passed, and he voted for bills that passed simply because he was there, he was present, and he moved these things forward. So there are definitive consequences, and if the person who steps forward as the Democrat, as the progressive, if the person who steps forward is not willing to swallow every last ounce of shame and pride and lose all sense of shame and ask everybody for money and ask everybody to stand there and hold a sign for you, then they will lose. Then they will lose unless they're really, really lucky and they end up in a really nice district and people are just willing to go out and vote. Most of the time that doesn't happen unless they're willing to say, I'm going to sacrifice my time, my energy, my sweat, and my ego, my sense of self-worth in asking and begging people for money, then there will be consequences. Women will be denied the right reproductive rights over their bodies. The GLBT community will be trampled under further. Progressive politics and ideology all across the board will suffer as a result of one person not doing enough, not doing what it takes to go out and win, just sort of hoping for the best and just riding that election cycle to the end. That sense of urgency is one of the most powerful things that I try to relate to the local candidates, because if you're gonna step forward to the plate, you need to knock a home run. You need to knock it out of the park, because if you don't, we're gonna all lose.
Yes.
I have two more minutes.
Okay.
So closing thoughts, please.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I like, Progressive Push, we offer advice, free of cost to candidates. We can have call conferences. If you contact me directly at luis@progressivepush.org. Send me a note. I'll get back with you. Somebody in the organization will get back with you, and we will look at everything that goes on. And we have the capability of being able to look at your district and eventually give you a targeting, strategy for your district. But one thing that I would like also is to have Joe's organization contact, and I think that we can definitely work with each other and with Food's Not Bomb. You know, we like to do networking, so let us know.
That's what we're here for. We're here to help the whole state network. That's what the Progressive News Network is all about. So we have 1 minute. I want to thank every single one of you for spending an hour with us tonight. It was very informative. I know that's a lot for people to think about. Keith McHenry, Food Not Bombs, Luis Cuevas, Progressive Push, and Joe Pishkar from the Space Coast Progressive Alliance. Thank you all so much. And we will have you all on back again, maybe not at the same time, but I have no doubt you'll be back. So thank you. Thank you very, very much. And remember, everybody, go to floridaredistricting.org to make your reservation to speak. And we'll see you next Sunday. And if you Tell your friends. They can listen to it on the internet now. It'll be up there. If you hear some of this again, you can just play it back. Thanks.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody.
It was a pleasure. Good night.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Next week, Rick should be back. Take care, everybody.
There's a better world is coming. Tell you why. There's a better world is coming. Tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world is coming. Tell you why. There's a better world is coming. Don't you see? There's a better world is coming. Don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world a coming, don't you see?
Thanks for listening.
There's a better world a coming, and don't you know? There's a better world a coming, don't you know?